Paulo Soleri talking with graduate students, April 12, 1977, College of Architecture, Arizona State University. Side one.
In the use of curvilinear forms, mm-hmm. you know, very large mm-hmm. Forms responding to the sun, which you know, some of the Pueblo Indians did and mm-hmm. so forth, you can look at them and get an equilibrium of heat gain mm-hmm. throughout as an overall thing. But one of the things that happens is that a particular area of them will be very hot, and another area will be very, very cold. You know, and these happen at different times of day, and it may not be when you want them particularly.
Mm-hmm. How I think there are two answers. One is that naturally you have the greenhouse, which would tend to equalize that. But the main source of heat will not be there. What you get between the two blades of the sun heating the specific spot that is the apron that would produce the main flow of air. Mm-hmm. So that would be part of the answer. The other is that there are people that have preferences, not only in the kind of light, but the kind of when the sun comes in, and maybe even perhaps some variations in temperature. For instance, I like to have the sunshine in the morning. Quite a bit. Maybe other people are getting up late in the day, they might like to get the sunshine in the evening, or not sunshine. So I don't think that an identical, even if it's an optimal condition, is really a desirable one, because then on those terms we tend to go back to this idea that only the perfect is human, which is the air conditioning, where if it's not 81 or 79 plus that kind of humidity, you're in bad shape, which is a substantial nonsense, because naturally it depends on the hour, depends on the mood, depends on the season, depends on so many things, and we tend to obliterate that, and we say that if you're alive, that's it, it's this, or you are underprivileged, or you are nutty, or you are crazy, or whatever. And so I think that variation within limits, I think it might be not only interesting, but perhaps desirable.
How do you, within that kind of variation, which is desirable for humans, there is a more limited range of what's acceptable in terms of
plants.
In terms of like the heat, you know, the human body won't.
Oh yeah.
You know, its comfort range and so forth.
Yeah, but
how are you moving heat around?
As I was saying, the main criteria would be to let the heat move itself, and then within that scheme, which is in a way simplistic, you might come up with some sophistication. But it goes from opening a window to maybe turning a switch, possibly less switches to turn and more window to open, or something of that kind. Again, considering that it might be important to be resensitized to the daily cycles, to feel a little chilly in the morning might be a very good reminder that the morning are cooler. To feel a little warm in the afternoon might be a very important experience, to know that the afternoon are warmer.
It's easier in Arizona than in China.
No, it doesn't mean that you have to be cold or hot. It means that the it's not true that total comfort is good for feeling alive. Total comfort, it's some kind of a condition where you forget that you have a body. And I don't think that's very good. Because the body is unforgettable. And it's also unforgiving. And if it becomes, if some situation is such that where you become desensitized, then the body might respond by saying, oh, I give up. What's my function?
Another question related is, have you done any work, or are you utilizing any work related to control of microclimates, you know, wind control, plants, and things like that?
Well, when you get into the greenhouse notion, evidently you're dealing with microclimates. And then when you're transferring the idea of microclimates from the house to the community, then evidently you're making a step towards something which is more complex, in many ways more demanding. But it's all microclimate. You are you know that the outside climate is something that you want to alter in relation to the needs of the group and the plants and so on. So we're dealing with microclimates. But if you're asking me what we are doing now about it, the answer is that we're dealing in generalities as yet because we haven't got down to the particular. And we are trying to get some money from Herder to get down to the particular. Herder is more interested in gadgets than in environments.
Yeah, they're sort of fascinated whether a lot of these models and so forth being shown look like it would be quite interesting to see some of the responses related to wind tunnels and so forth, mm-hmm. because I think they're of a scale which obviously they're going to modify this.
Yeah, we have been trying to see how we can go about it. I got a letter from a man in Colorado. He seems to be the authority. He did quite a number of studies for town cities renewal structures. In fact, I think he worked on a trade center in New York. Also. He uses a wind tunnel and the simulations to do that work. So I might try to see if we can afford him.
Explain that effect that you had on the swimming pool again.
Oh, yeah. Well, the swimming pool is...
We have a slope which is east-southeast, somewhere like that. And then we have the original situation is that we have a shelf and then we have a cliff. And this is basaltic rock. And it accumulates quite a lot of heat. If you touch the rock in the evening, after many hours it's still warm, even in the spring or late summer or even in the fall. So what we did, we cut the swimming pool here.
Out of rock or is it dirt?
It's mostly dirt. We had some cutting here because the structure of the thing is all in this place. So we have some report here, fill here, and we built this wall. And we open gates there, that comes down here. And then we have a bedrock of about 14, 16 inches here. And the bedrock is carried through here, and so that you are going to have a system of vents on this side. And what we are going to do is to define here the beginning of the greenhouse. We are uncertain yet, but it's going to be deck and then the greenhouse. So this is the volume of the greenhouse here.
By greenhouse, do you mean just mare space, or would it actually be plants?
Right, it's going to be terraced. This is the general slope is going to be terraced.
So that won't be living space?
No, this will be cultivation. Food. So you get this sun energy and the chimney effect, and then you go into the
tree. Are the greenhouses planned to be shielded at night, or are they planned to be?
We have two ways to go, apparently. Basically, one way is a double membrane with possibly some kind of fluid going in, changing the transparency. Foam is one thing used now in Tucson.
A journey is to have one membrane and possibly louvers that can be opened, and we might use that approach. If we use that approach, the louvers would be made in insulation material, like styrofoam. So at night, you can, in winter, you can shut the louvers and get a fairly good insulation. And in the summer, the roofs would be shading.
Another thing I was wondering about is what determines how high the
building? Well, in this case, given this design, the shelf on which we are building has a certain dimension. So once you decide about the slope, somehow you're getting an answer there. Now that's not given to you the absolute answer, but it's...
You mentioned something about landscaping inside the building. Now you're going to have
explore different landscapes?
Yeah, there are, every two or three floors we have a fairly sizable area which would be public. And by public I mean ways of communication and also offices or maybe some kind of family activities like family industries. From crafts to, assemblage of the radios or things which are tailoring us, things of that sort. So those would be somehow landscaped.
You're going to have natural light somehow?
Most of it. We have quite a number of wells and light coming in from different directions.
I noticed most, all of your structures that we saw, the designs are above ground, and I imagine to save that amount of land that we do have. What are your thoughts on below ground?
Well, leaving, they're very negative. I've been connected with the idea of underground for many years. I don't know, but I can guess why, but it has always been wrong, because even the experiments we made in Scottsdale, they're not underground, they're below grade, which is something very different. So really to take life and put it underground, I think it's scarcely justifiable. I mean, it's not justifiable, I feel. And some of the experiments are telling us that there was in Texas, this developer, I think it was a developer, he started building underground houses. I don't know how far he got, but he built a few, I think, a number of feet underground. So as far as the conditioning, the climate conditioning, was, the answer was pretty good. But then it ended up by having microphones on the highway, bringing down the noise of the highway. And then he had all this paraphernalia of fake sounds, fake patios, everything was fake, because he had to take the environment that he abandoned and put it down on the ground. So at that point, the justification becomes very, very thin. So I would say that a number of activities can go on the ground, and probably they are going to go in Scandinavia, and in Sweden, they've been going on the ground quite a while. But leaving as such, I would reject it.
Saw that model. You said you now disband. What was wrong with it?
Well, I wish I could do it, but I had to try to come up with a design which number one was slightly easier to develop. Number two possibly was more energy oriented.
More what?
Energy oriented. Even though the climate is not a very harsh climate, it can get pretty cold or pretty hot. So the new model, from that point of view, it's more it works better.
Would that model have worked better around Phoenix area?
That model worked, yeah, because that model was mainly an idea that you make a very large umbrella, which is a parasol, and then under the umbrella you can build all sorts of things. In fact, that model, as it is in there, would be almost ideal for a place like San Diego or Los Angeles and so on. Where you really need is an umbrella for the summer sun. But then he had those elements which were somehow working with the sun and so on. But for that climate, probably the new model is more fitting. But also it would be a slightly easier to develop and start.
Well, on the north side of the Akasanti design, mm-hmm. like there's more greenhouses, right?
No, on the north side there are terraces, quite wide terraces, because the slope is 45 degrees. So those terraces there are only a few that are really facing north. They face north, northeast, and northwest. In fact, northwest and northeast. Go ahead.
Well, what I was wondering was, are they going to be louvered or closed as well?
I think that the idea will be to have very large, very good, very nice awnings, because then
In the winter you don't get very much sunshine, but in the summer you might get the very warm sunshine in early morning and late afternoon, and that's when Leonis would be very good. So you have a terrace, which is an extension of your living room.
And also at night, I was wondering at night, like since you energy oriented towards like maximizing sun stuff, I was wondering what would happen on that side at night.
Well, that's when you have to count on the heat sink and the help of the heat sink. So the structure would be warmed up during the day, and then we are trying also to decide about some bedrocks at the below the ground level, floor level of the main mall, and we have some pools there, including this bedrock, open like straight pools. So the combination of those two elements should bridge the night quite easily. In fact, we thought that even we thought there was some calculation that showed that you would lose one degree during a night preceding after a sunless day. Yeah, you have an inertia there, which is quite substantial, and then actually you have only one phase which is exposed to the outside, because all the rest is exposed to the inner area. Which is again the reason why the body is more effective than the surface. I mean, if you have a single house, you have all those, the area exposed is much greater than if you have a one building.
So there's no real need to seal up that side at all?
No, it would be convenient to have a double glazing if you like, but possibly it would not be necessary. Maybe some curtains at all.
When you first started developing your arcology concept, what variables did you choose to deal with at that time? There must have been something disconcerting about architecture at that time that stimulated your interest in
it. Well, as I was saying, I was trying to, in my own way, to work out a system that would not be giving up too much of the city ethos, of the cultural character that the city has to deliver. But I kept somehow ending up by finding out that unless you take care of the logistics, you have problems. So the logistics eventually told me that instead of having this kind of thing, you have to have this kind of thing.
And energy has become a more important input now?
Well, energy was very important then, because basically that's where you're saving. Consider the difference between the automobile, the single person automobile, and the elevator, which is most of the time is a collective transportation system. And the imbalance between the two, I think, is very great. The elevator is far more saving. And naturally, then, the elevator is only part of the process. Your walking ability is the basic device by which you move things, including yourself. So you were moving from a gigantic technology, the automobile, to a minute technology, your legs, basically. And that's a tremendous difference.
Is in the new development of the design of Arco Santi, is there horizontal transportation?
Arco Santi is so small that we will need some transportation of that sort for a few people, handicapped, older people, and babies.
But so are there pedestrian malls located?
It's all pedestrian malls.
And
the ground floor, it's all circulation among greenery and maybe open markets and so on. And then there are many levels in which circulation is also very substantial.
Are you allowed for parking?
I mean, we have parking on the northwest side, in designs it's indicated. And the parking, we would like to think that instead of needing a car per, let's say, three persons, I don't know what's the average here, you might need a car per five or six or seven persons. The reason is that possibly we would rent the car we need when we need it. So you would have a pool. And the advantage of having a pool is that you pick up the car that you need at that day. And if it's a small car that you need, you pick it up. If it's a station wagon, you pick it up and so on.
but that would cut the size of the car fleet maybe to 1/3 or.
What would be the expense of living there? I mean,
would it be higher? Altogether, again, if we are not dealing with a prototype, since we are after frugality, the justification of it is that it would be cheaper to live in that kind of environment. But we have to come up with figures.
Would any individual own anything in that?
Well, you could own probably as much as you want to, up to the real estate, I don't know. But, you know, you have your clothing, you have your books, you have your furnishing, if that's what you like. If you want to own a car, probably you would own a car. But you might find out that it's a burden that you might not want to take.
Could you actually talk about the construction that's going on now? While the process is like different techniques we've been using.
Yeah. Well, as you know, we're doing concrete work. And the concrete is it's a mix of precasting, casting in place, pouring in place, assemblage.
Slow process?
Well, it's slow mainly because we don't have enough resources, and also because we are not professionals.
And you get away with this from the building officials that they come down?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
So you are under
there? Oh, we are under there. Yeah.
Do you have a full set of working drawings, or do you just go from one?
No, we are getting more and more in having full sets of working drawings, which we didn't have when we were building our Cosanti. That was improvisation. But you cannot go, you know, beyond those kind of things without working drawings.
What if someone wanted to take up one of your other plans? Do you have drawings for those, set of drawings?
Oh, no. You mean our colleges?
Yeah.
Oh. We have to start from zero.
Question about what does an individual own? So, like, property is not, like, property in terms of real estate is not individually owned. It's personal property, right?
Well, it's not that we are dogmatic about it.
But, like, that comes less desired.
Yeah.
My question isn't really about the physical thing, because, like, you know, that's what speaks. Like, what I was wondering about, like, is there, like, some sort of philosophical basis for going in this direction as opposed to, like, that direction? Like, just, you know, like...
Well, I would say that it's even more than philosophical, it's theological.
Okay.
But, you see, it's connected with this notion that there are indications in history, and I mean not just history, but prehistory, evolution, that things click when they go this way, and they don't click when they go that way. And the clicking happens always when you move from the simple into the less simple. And actually, this is resisted this day and age, because we decided that technology is the evil that makes things complicated. But technology makes things complicated, not complex, because technology is complicated by nature, but it's not complex. In fact, it's another simplification, and that's where the trouble comes in. We analyze our needs, then we start to say, unless we have a washing machine which does that, we are unhappy. And then actually that ethos has to be transferred to everything. So you need a gadget for any single little thing that you do. But that's simple-minded. It's not complexifying. Complexity is something very different. Complexity is the ability to grasp the totality and then come up with a synthesis. And in that synthesis, you can use technology. But that would be a slightly different technology than what we are doing now most of the time.
Okay, yeah. Can you cite a couple of possible historic or even prehistoric references?
Well, not a couple, but by the billions.
Okay.
You know, all, if you go through, and not that I know, but if other people know, if you go through the process, from the very beginning, you find out that at the beginning you have a very simple-minded triggering enzymes or whatever, you know, so things which are utterly simple compared to what we have now. And then throughout the historical evolution, you see that those very simple creatures constantly sought to become more complex,
in very strange ways, by mutations, by accidents and so on, so that you kept moving from a condition which is very originally very simple, and there's still a presence with us because viruses are here, amoebas were there and so on, but at the same time yes, they have this build-up of conditions which are far more lively, far more sensitive, far more responding to environmental stresses, up to the point where the mind appears.
So Estelle was going to be the next thing. Do you anticipate any kind of potential evolutionary things as a result of an evolutionary thing as living environment?
Well, it's not that we are expecting, we are living it. And we have been living it forever.
Okay.
For 3,500,000,000 of years. So it's a long process. There is nothing uncertain about it. And nothing too extravagant of it. It's a bloody, momentous, robust, impressive, miraculous process. So to cancel that from our mind and say, no, that's wrong, that doesn't exist, that's fantasy, it's, at this point it's slightly ridiculous.
It's not as gigantic a step as it seems, it's a logical step.
Tiny little steps. Yeah, but naturally, when we appear and we are beginning to look around and say, this is not me, that is not me, that's something else, then you begin to be conscious of your envelope, of your limitations, of your future and so on. At that point, things begin to accelerate, at least in the mind of man, if not in the performance. So we are living accelerated times, but that doesn't mean that we are going to get everything tomorrow morning. It's going to be a painful, long, but very glorious process, and we are part of it.
You said that as far as energy goes, you can do, it's just going to go as far as agriculture and heating right now. What happens if we have to go to individual power? Would we have to rebuild this whole system inside Arkosani, or are you prepared?
Well, in a way, we would better prepare for it, because we would have already those conditions which are allowing us to survive, you know, without a high percentage of the energy that is needed now in other places. And you could add probably to that that technology that might produce also electric energy. So I think that at this point, it might not be the wisest thing to say we're going to be 100% self-sufficient. If you could say, if in general the United States could say we're going to be 30% dependent, not on capital, but on income energy, that would be a gigantic step. But we think we can do much better now. We can probably do 80% or something.
Can you use something like this up north? Or?
Well, in many ways, the further north we go, the more it's justified. The investment of growing with the sun, up to a point at least. If it gets too cold or too cloudy and so on, then the justification might be less strong.
Just interested in that. Many of the models that show what appear to be very large public spaces that are fully enclosed,
mm-hmm.
glazing building above or something.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that kind of opposite of where your philosophy is going in terms of your people in that kind of environment are getting farther from nature in that respect? You know, mm-hmm. Nature may be outside of it and available, but your daily kind of functioning might be in
well,
more
I think,
artificial.
I think there's a double answer again. One is that naturally there are conditions which are not very, very acceptable. Or they are quite harsh, and I'm not suggesting that we should live in a harsh condition by choice. I'm suggesting we can temper the harsh condition without getting into this kind of total deprivation of our senses. So if you have 10 degrees outside, you might try to get up to 50 degrees, and then you can actively take part of that kind of environmental condition. Or if you have 110 outside, you might say, well, let's try to go down to 90 or 80. What would you gain by containment is that you're in such a situation where to get out from the containment becomes very easy. It becomes very easy because it doesn't cost you anything. You are there and you can step out of it. Well, if you're in the middle of Phoenix now, you cannot step out of it. You have to be privileged enough to own a car, privileged enough to have enough time to step out of it. So suddenly you find out that unless you belong to an elite, you are cursed.
It's a function of scale, then.
Well, yeah, the human scale is very...
But in
a way, the ecology negates the possibility. It doesn't want to become there. So if the walking distance becomes burdensome, then you have to try to reduce it.
The reason I asked the question, a few years ago, I worked on some housing for the Arctic, and one of our first concepts was a mass collective units. And with some shared common space. And people living there were absolutely opposed to that. They accepted to going out in 25-35 below zero, which totally amazed us. There was that kind of adaption. They would between houses. You know, they wanted their shopping enclosed that way, but they didn't want any the rest of their life. It's really quite a surprise.
Not everything we do makes sense. Yeah. You know.
What stops the metropolitan area from moving into where you are now?
Nothing but the will not to stop it. And I mean the collective will.
We
have 860 acres, and if the right of ownership still holds, then you can say that we have that buffer.
Curtis Junction may become the next thing.
Your physical forms, I enjoy them very much myself, but is there anything that you can say that did you ever study origins of some of those, or are they entirely your own? Is it entirely conceptual that's actually becoming material, or did you actually study, you know, historical patterns that some of these forms relate to? Do you have any specific examples that you follow?
Yeah, there are, for instance, when somebody comes up and they see the apsis, they say, oh, it looks Roman or Byzantine or whatever, which might be true, but it's very irrelevant because the function is so different. But that's hard to tell. Yeah, I had a background on fine arts, if you want to call it that way. So that means that I had to go through a certain experience in reading history or also in graphics and so on. So that makes for you what you might call your personal style, whatever you want to call it. But then the overriding thing, it's not the style, it's how do you use the style for what purposes. And in the ecology, even though there are many variations, the notion is always one, fundamentally. Contain, reduce, minimize, and put more intensity in it.
Yes, there seems to be, I noticed the difference seems to be between some of the conceptual ideas which tend to make more free flowing or something, which tend to maybe look like veins or, you know, whatever, just original forms, but then when you actually get to the model building of an actual structure that might be built, I notice that it always becomes geometric.
Is
that because of?
Well, there are reasons there which are, one is that it's fine and dandy to be very free on paper, but that doesn't mean in three-dimensionally function, so very often you have to, in a way, slow down or try to do your best.
Is that what you would desire to do if you had the ability with materials?
Well, at this point, no, because I find right more and more that the organic is not that free flow, the organic is something quite different. It's really the performance, because when we talk about organic, we usually think in terms of our biological system, and we would like to translate it into a non-biological system, which is pure arbitrary, there is not really a justification for that, because one thing is a living creature that grows and crawls and does a thing, another thing is to define an environment like the architectural environment, which by definition is something quite different. So when you see a design that looks like a crab or whatever you see, don't talk about organic, that's pseudo-organic most of the time. You have to investigate what that thing delivers and then begin to talk about organic. So if you take, for instance, sometimes the question comes up, but at Kozanti in Scottsdale you are organic and over there you're not organic. Well, I reversed the thing and I said in Scottsdale I'm more or less appealing to the person that thinks in organic in a certain term, but the real organic is going to be there. It's going to be organic because it's going to be far more pertinent to that kind of condition that you feel is going to respond to your needs.
You have the ability, or if you feel the situation arises where you should be organic, then you will strive to use
what
the
materials. What I mean is that the thing that looks less organic are basically the more organic, in terms of the more apt and the more living. So one thing is the appearance, and the copying or the faking or the emulation or simulation, or and the other one is the actual delivery that the system does.
Is the attempt at very high quality presentation drawings and everything, is this to sell your ideas, are you very much involved in this process of presentation, or is this somebody else that's promoting your ideas?
I used to. I do less and less of that because of time and other things.
Oh, right.
I used to like very much to do good presentations because I felt that there is a certain necessity, especially if you're in the field of the aesthetics, not to postpone the process, but to involve the aesthetic process in whatever you do. So if you write a page or if you present a diagram, that diagram should at least carry some of the aesthetic impact that might be eventually carried on by the next thing.
Bob's question about the organic, I'm also sort of fascinated that way, because now we've got the technology to become much freer with our forms than rectilinear and stuff like that. Concrete and foams and all sorts of these things would allow you to build almost what you've drawn, and it's always...
Yeah, let's take this room, for instance. It's pretty, you can say it's pretty stiff, pretty inorganic, but let's start to warp this room. Start to get that wall to go up this way. Start to get the corn to go around that way. Are you really getting something which is more organic? My answer is no. Are you getting something which is trying to do something which, you know, because you're going to bump your head, because you're not going to be able to put a board, because you're not able to do so many things that this room can do for you. So the idea that since we are not made of angles or straight surfaces, it means that everything has to be like we are, it's a poor idea, I'm afraid. And I can tell you because I went through, you know, I did quite a bit of that. I love to curve things and so on, but slowly you realize that quite a bit of that is not really giving the answer that you're after. And once you bump your head 20 times against a bolt, and you start wondering.
That's maybe a detail.
Should you walk that way also?
The detail in handling that kind of design. I mean.
Yeah, but I would.
Quite,
you know,
nice,
I've been in few places that they were defined as organic, and I find them fanciful or extravagant. But
I find a problem, maybe because of my, you know, our standard perceptual background, mm-hmm. and expanding that a single foam house that's really a pleasant environment to, you know, expanding it to a couple thousand of them, that free form quality tends to, I think, perhaps lead to confusion.
Yeah.
And
that brings in the question of quality, which is very often it takes many years to, it's hard to get to. you know, was that there's been such an outburst of doing my own thing and do it whichever way that I wanted, that quality has been going down and down and down and down. And if you want to have poor things, generally you look at the thing that very young people do, and it's natural. You're experimenting.
Are you opposed to all of Frank Lloyd Wright's theories on organic architecture, or is there anything that you think is valid?
No, I think that he had a very powerful notion about organic. Maybe it was limited, but it wasn't, you know, the idea that since a crab looks beautiful, you're going to make a crab house, or since a flower looks beautiful, you're going to make a parasol, which is a flower. That wasn't his notion. The organic for him was the nature, the true nature of what he was observing, and then trying to synthesize, to translate that nature, not the appearance, but the nature of that, into an architectural expression. That's why most of super-organic failed, because it's just copying. You know, the crab is this big, I'm going to make it this big. Naturally, it's a novelty, so everybody said, oh, look at that big crab. Well, after 25 years, maybe after 25 days, you said, oh, Jesus, I wish that crab wasn't there. Because a crab is something, and that's a fake. Because the element of novelty, as always, is very enticing. So if I see something this size, which has an interesting morphology, and I say, oh, imagine if this was multiplied 100 times. And one of the sculptures does that. What's his name? No, the one that makes a facet 25 stories on. Well, as a fantasy, or as a idiosyncrasies, or as a as a celebration of something, it's fine. But when they are going to last 50 years or 100 years, and you have thousands of those, then the whole civilization might be in troubles. It's another story.
What
about
form follows function then?
Those crabs, I mean, those things very rarely really are responding well to needs.
Well, I can relate it to then you were talking about the vaulted ceiling and that wall. Well, maybe if the function of that wall is to hang a vertical blackboard on it, how do the two interact, and does that maybe part of the identity of that wall is the aesthetic or the experience of yeah. Just because it's a negative space and non-usable doesn't mean that it doesn't have a purpose.
No, I'm not saying that we should build this way. I'm saying that we have to be very careful in not confusing what are we talking about. Just to curve, because that's more organic than to have straight, it's really nonsensical. But if I am a Brunelleschi or a great architect, then curving might become something very, very important. But just curve for the sake of not doing straight. Straight is as justifiable as curve. I mean, it's not that one is evil, the other is good. It's how you make use of it.
Also, to the nature of the materials.
Yes, but keeping in mind that we are transformers and we are manipulators and we are small recomposing things, and there's a limit beyond which nature materials is self-defeating. Because if you take an ore that it might be made into, you make into iron. Iron has a certain capacity, and then you say, well, I want something which is more subtle than iron, so you move into steel, and you have another kind of capacity. So where is the nature material? Clay that remains clay, or clay that becomes aluminum? Oil that remains oil, or oil that becomes plastics? You're dealing with a very ambiguous nature material situation.
I don't know that it's that ambiguous, and that dealing in the existing marketplace, you're dealing with, you know, not ore, but you're dealing with steel. Well, you're not dealing with oil, but you're dealing with plastics. And then if you limit your dealing at that level, then the plastic has certain potentials, the steel has a range of potentials, wood, you know.
What I mean is that I may take that plastic and I might make it into something quite different. As I can take wood and I might make it something quite different. So there isn't a logic which is unbreakable in the idea of the nature of materials. It depends on the date, for instance.
Someone asked you if you died, would your?
I'm sure I died. I mean, there's not the
right. But when you die, will Arkosani keep going? Is there someone that's like your right hand man who knows how to carry on?
There's a number of people that have been with me quite a number of years, but that no matter what you do, you never get a real answer there. Frank LaRive is a very good example. Who could take the place of Frank LaRive? Just another Frank LaRive. So that you get one of those people once in a while. So what should have the foundation done? Well, one would be to fold over and disappear. The journalists would try to carry on the best they can carry on some of the ideas of Frank LaRive, which is what they are trying to do. So in a way, I feel that it's somehow a waste of time to try to legalize and to structure what's happened after you're not there. Because in a sense, you carry coercion beyond your lifetime. You give orders even when you aren't there anymore.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about
well, that's serious. One way of doing it. You know, you dogmatize and said, after my death, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And the poor people that are left, they have to obey, because the lawyer is going to tell, no, you have to do that, you cannot do that.
Do you envision a whole world of psychology?
Not in the sense that the design that you see that I worked on, that evidently not that, but in the sense of turning the tide of urban sprawl and moving back into the idea of the city as a very fundamental phenomenon. Yes.
And ecology can coexist with urban sprawl.
Well, yeah. Suppose that the idea takes hold, then you would have a long process of transformation from one kind to the other kind.
Done any work in terms of looking at Los Angeles or Phoenix or Denver or a sprawl city in terms of
no, unless you are asked, and some cash comes with the demand, we cannot even afford to do what we are doing, let alone go around. And
do you see the social and political structures of Arkosanti as continuing in the existing structures in this country today, or altering
them? Well, I think the political structure are a reflection of the ethos of a group of people. So if the main drive is materialistic, there's not very much choice, I think. If the main drive begins to alter, then evidently the political structure will reflect that. Political structure is a service system for the feeling of a society. In a way, we got exactly what we're asking for.
Following the lecture, one of the questions someone asked about the relationship of going very high, and your answer was related to the idea of clustering is something historically is not new, but there is a difference in terms of historically the cluster was a maximum of two stories, maybe three, and Rome had as high
seven,
as
seven, eight stories in mud, still existing, still standing somewhere in Africa.
Yeah, but these are very quite few and rare, but the common situation was several stories, two or three.
Several stories.
And quite dense, but these were also at densities that were not as great as we're talking about. They usually allowed courtyards for animals and other spaces, a very close relationship to the ground and nature. You know, so this is
If you have to take a medieval town, at least originally, you are right, you have a thoroughfare, then you have the houses with the backyard. And naturally, as soon as you get into the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, you have a much greater cluster in much higher densities. And you can say, well, that wasn't very good, and you're right. But that wasn't very good for a number of reasons, which have probably not to do with crowding, but with other reasons. Health difference in economic capacities and greed and injustice and so on. But the connection of crowding with crime has been debunked, I think, and it's going to be debunked more and more. There's a study by, there's a book by Freeman, Crowding and Behavior, and I think the library should have it if it doesn't have it, because it through that, those studies and through those experiments which were being financed by a number of foundations, this man was able to totally unhinge crowding from crime. One of the results was that given a group of people, and he was experimenting with students, a group of people that is in very friendly terms, the smaller the room you put them in for a number of days to work together, the greater is the intensity of the cooperation and the fruitfulness of the group. But if the group is not friendly from starting, the more you shrink the space, the more tension is going to be built up. So the results are not dependent on the crowding, it's depending on the nature of the group. In other words, an ideal society can stand a tremendous crowding, because that's where somehow more relationships are going to develop, more social relationships and cultural relationships. If the group is poor by definition in terms of relatedness, then crowding becomes a problem.
It seems that if you go very high and very high density, you have maybe, you know, there's some point of decreasing returns in terms of to create some, you know, psychological sense of connection with nature, the addition of gardens and so forth, structurally or physically, or cost or whatever, are going to be more difficult to provide.
Yeah, but you see, the most difficult way to provide those is suburbia.
Yeah, you know,
unless we decide that nature is something we want to get rid of it, and suburbia is something that we want to put in, not because suburbia might pervade everything, which is not true, there's lots of room. But because once you are separated by, let's say, 5 miles away and 5 miles away and 5 miles away, you're really isolated from nature. And what you got, you got a pseudo-nature, which is your little garden or your little hotel, courtyard, and so on.
What I'm talking about is that it's hard for me to accept the either-or in the argument, the suburb or as the alternative, that I think, you know, what you're working at in terms of Arcosani right now is obviously not 50 or 100 stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, and I, those, that smaller scale, I think, has an appeal.
Well, yeah, I
there's
think that's
expansion beyond, okay, which it's pretty hard for me to.
Well, yeah, but you're right, but that's a question of scheduling. To say that that's going to be true 50 generations from now might be a nonsense. Number one, we don't know. But number two, evolution seems to be pointing in the other way. Evolution seems to be saying that it's not going to be, it's going to be that. So there's only one resource that we have to try to extrapolate, and that's history. Beyond that, we don't have anything to work with. If history tells us that that's the direction, then we might as well try to understand why and possibly move in that direction. So I would say that the scheduling is to be such as not to suddenly transport the Phoenicians into a 150 stories building, but that doesn't mean that eventually the what used to be the Phoenicians might be in something which is even more incredible than that.
Yeah,
it's a question of time. Time
another 50,000 years or something, maybe.
100.
that an Arcosanti relates to nature, and because of its compactness, it seemed to me like it relies on a nature, a closeness to nature that's not disturbed. So if it were surrounded by suburbia or anything, it would be destroyed.
For sure. The animal per se cannot be isolated, and the animal needs a territory, and the territory in this case it's the ground that is around it, and the ground cannot become an habitat like Scots or South Phoenix or anything, because then you defeat one of the purposes of the animal, which is number one the contrast between the man-made and what you might call the natural, number two the effectiveness of the contained system, less pollution, less energy consumption, and all those things.
So is there a limit to the size that Arcosanti could become?
Well, Arcosanti, yes, because it's on that little edge, as I was saying. And then once you design the structure, you cannot totally ignore it. You have to stay with the logic of the structure. That's when I was saying that suppose you have 5,000 people there for a number of years, or you go up toward the 5,000 and the thing is pretty successful, before you get to the 5,000, the community might decide that another Arcosanti might have to be developed. So you get land 20 miles away or 3,000 miles away or whatever, and you begin to construct the new community, which is very organic because that's how it happens in nature. The beehive doesn't go on forever, at least a new beehive. The coyote group doesn't get bigger and bigger. It splits in discrete coyote groups, and so on and on.
Well, just hypothetically, let's say that this system was the new system that was to be taken over. What would happen to the land that Phoenix is on and everything else if Phoenix went into one of these things?
Well, there might be many alternatives. One is that population in Arizona for some reason keeps going up. That would mean that possibly Phoenix, the area that now contains Phoenix could contain double the population of Phoenix, but instead of being completely paved over or completely built, it might be two or three isolated systems with lots of gardens around and so on.
But what would you do with the now existing thing?
Things evolve, things appear and things disappear. Where was Babylon thousands of years ago, there is dust now. Where was, the Indian dwellers, or the Indian town, there are some ruins now.
Troy, seven cities.
Seven cities, one for the ocean. So it would be important to be able to have a movie made of, the how New York went through its own cycle, or how Phoenix developed, so that in few minutes you see what took two or three generations through, and then you see the incredible dynamics which are involved in this continuous changing that life is. Because otherwise we get a feeling that since Van Buren and Washington are there, Van Buren and Washington are going to be there forever. They're not going to be there forever. I can guarantee that. If it's something that's going to be very sure, is that Washington and Bermuda are going to be there forever.
One of the really difficult design problems of a large scale system is to not to design in too much. The reason that vernacular groups of housings are really interesting is that they've accumulated over time, and there's interest and so forth. They're very difficult to actually try to design in. Happen because of changing needs, and isn't that the problem if you try to design too much at one time?
Yeah, but there's another face of the problem, which is cowardice. If we really keep snilling that nothing can be designed because nothing is going to be lasting, then we'll be sitting forever on on meeting the chairman of boards or whatever, you know, endless discussions, endless piles of material, research, theoretical papers, analysis, archives, full of things and very little happening. So the least, the more and more we feel that that's the way to go, the more timid and the more cowardly we are becoming in our actual
within your archaeology. How do you allow for those variations in design,
well,
which create great interest?
You really make a quite a firm statement. We are interested in environmental degradation. We are interested in segregation. We need to be dispelled somehow. We want to save energy. We want to save materials. We want to be able to feed ourselves and see where the crops are growing and maybe help them grow.